In the United States, more than 400,000 people have died from opioid overdoses in the last decade. And another fact, in 1 year alone, 2015, more than 326 million opioid pills were dispensed in Oklahoma. Population less than 4 million. That was an observation made by the judge who a week or so ago in the first opioid lawsuit to go to trial ordered Johnson & Johnson to pay $572 million for helping to fuel Oklahoma's opioid crisis. And a few days later, a federal judge in Cleveland, Ohio, ruled that lawyers can argue to a jury that drug companies' deceptive marketing and lack of oversight propagated a wave of addiction and death. That trial begins next month. And OxyContin maker Purdue offered to settle all the lawsuits it's facing since pleading guilty in 2007 to misleading doctors and patients about the risks of opioid. Scott Hyam is a Pulitzer Prize-winning member of the Washington Post Investigations Unit. He's covered the opioid epidemic for a long time now. And indeed, the Washington Post is among the newspapers that has fought for more than a year to get data released which showed just how much opioid was going into very small communities. Scott Hyam joins me now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good morning.
Let's just talk about the data that you got released for a moment. This is part of that federal lawsuit that's going to start in Cleveland next month. Is that right?
That's correct. There are 2,000 cities, towns, and counties in America that are suing the opioid industry. There's about 24 companies that are standing trial, accused of deceptive marketing, and also accused of violating the laws that regulate the sale of narcotics in the United States. And as part of this trial, there was some data that was shared among the parties. It's data that's kept by the Drug Enforcement Administration, which is a federal agency in the United States. And this data has been kept secret for many, many years. And the Washington Post, along with another small newspaper, the Gazette Mail in West Virginia, which is a place that has suffered catastrophic losses because of the opioid epidemic, sued for access to this data. And like you said, it took us a year to win this court fight, but we finally won access to that data. And we won access to thousands and thousands of internal company emails, memorandums, and sworn depositions of company officials.
The data the data runs between the years 2006-2012. What does it show significantly?
It shows that 76 billion doses of oxycodone and hydrocodone pills were distributed across the United States of America during those 7 years. And that's just a jaw-dropping amount of pills. It shows that there was only a handful of companies that were responsible for manufacturing those pills. Most people think of Purdue Pharma when they think of opioids in the United States, but Purdue Pharma hasn't been manufacturing that many pills in quite some time because they got into trouble a decade ago and were fined and were criminally charged. But a number of other companies stepped into the breach and began manufacturing these pills in massive quantities. A company called Mallinckrodt, they are one of the largest manufacturers of opioids in America. Another company called Activist and another company called Par Pharmaceuticals. Those three companies manufactured the vast majority of the pills that that washed across the landscape of the United States of America.
Did you say that the Drug Enforcement Agency had had this data for years?
Yes, exactly. They had it for years, but this data was kept by very small division within the Drug Enforcement Administration. And it was a division that was never given much of a high priority because all they look at is prescription drugs. They don't do the big headline-grabbing cocaine cases, heroin cases, big marijuana busts, big meth arrests. So this was a backwater at the DEA. There was not a lot of people assigned to this division, and the database was a mess. When it was turned over to the lawyers in the lawsuit in the case that's pending in Cleveland, they couldn't make heads or tails of it. And the men and women who were working in this division were highly dedicated, but they had a very, very hard time, A, getting enough resources to do the work and go after these companies, and to get money to fix this database so they could actually see what was going on across the country. They could see some of it. They did make some of the cases, but these are complicated cases. They take years to put together, and they only had a few hundred people in that division.
So are they going to be embarrassed by this?
The agency itself, I think, is under a lot of scrutiny. The heads of the agency, the people who ran the agency, there are a lot of questions as to why this division was not given a higher priority, why prescription drugs were not given a higher priority, why there were not more cases made against these companies back in the time when so many people were dying. So there's a lot of questions being asked in the United States right now.
Let's go back to that Oklahoma case where Johnson & Johnson has been ordered to pay $572 million, which is nothing, right?
Yeah, and that is only for 1 year. That's just for abatement of the epidemic in Oklahoma for 1 year, and the judge has said that after that year is up, he's going to revisit this and see if he's going to order Johnson & Johnson to pay more money. In addition to the amount of deaths that the drugs have created, it's been an enormous it's had enormous impact on the foster care system because so many children don't have parents anymore. It's been an enormous burden on hospitals that are taking care of children who are born drug addicted. It's taken an enormous impact on facilities that provide drug treatment for people, hospitals, police departments, fire departments. Fire departments, you would think that most firemen and women are putting out fires in America and a lot of these small towns. They're giving Narcan to people who are overdosing. That's an anti-overdose drug. And a lot of firefighters, paramedics, spend their entire day just trying to revive people from overdoses.
It's such an interesting story, right? Because the way it worked out, a Purdue Pharma back in 1996 when they introduced OxyContin, they marketed it so aggressively. They persuaded everyone that pain was being undertreated and that opioids were non-addictive. I mean, that's a fact, right?
That is a fact. And they paid a lot of doctors to spread that message.
Corrupt doctors. Are corrupt doctors going to be in the dock as well? Because it goes right through the chain, doesn't it?
Absolutely. A lot of doctors have gone to jail for over-prescribing or for trading prescriptions for drugs. I mean, for cash, drugs for cash, trading prescriptions for sex. There have been criminal enterprises that have been broken up and people have gone to jail. And then what started happening after that is the Drug Enforcement Administration, this small division within the Drug Enforcement Administration, began to realize that they could arrest doctors all day long. And they started looking up the supply chain and seeing where all the drugs were coming from. And they started going after the manufacturers of these drugs, and they started going after the distributors of these drugs. And those are the companies that are standing trial today.
The use by the Oklahoma judge of the public nuisance laws has been controversial. Some fear that other industries, such as the oil and gas producers, will be vulnerable to public nuisance laws about climate change. Do you think that public nuisance laws were the right thing to use in this case?
Well, I think you make a really good point. I think the oil and gas industry is nervous about this, and perhaps they should be, because I think this was a test case. It showed for the first time that that this public nuisance theory, legal theory, carries weight. And a judge sided with the plaintiffs in this case. And this was a theory that was developed by a lawyer named Paul Farrell, who's from West Virginia. He saw firsthand how his entire community was destroyed by these drugs. And he said, you know, this is a nuisance at the greatest degree, and I'm going to file a lawsuit based on this public nuisance law. Other states and counties and cities followed suit. And the first test case was in Oklahoma, and the judge sided with the plaintiffs in that. And that is a theory that's also being used in this massive case of 2,000 cities, towns, and counties that is pending in Cleveland that's about to go to trial on October 21st.
Will this mean the end of Purdue Pharma? Their settlement is pretty punitive. They've got to declare bankruptcy. The family is going to have to, the Sackler family is going to have to put in at least $3 billion in personal funds to the settlement, and the Purdue Pharma will have to become a public benefit trust. Is that the end of that company?
I think everybody who's been following this believes it is the end of Purdue Pharma. There's no way that the company can survive, and a lot of people believe that the company shouldn't survive, and a lot of people believe that the company is getting off easy. That's not a lot of money for a company that the size of Purdue Pharma, that used to be the size of Purdue Pharma. The Sackler family has removed money from that company, what's going to be left over is anybody's guess. Nobody really knows how much money Purdue Pharma is worth because it's not a publicly traded company. It's not on the stock exchange in the United States, so their financials are not public record. So nobody really knows exactly how much money is going to be there. I think there's a lot of lawyers who fear that they're saying they have more money than they actually do, and at the end of the day, there's not going to be much money left for the people who are so devastated by these drugs.
Well, you know, it's been said that the tobacco companies paid out billions of dollars, but that the states spend only a fraction on smoking prevention and amelioration, and most on entirely, you know, unrelated vanity projects. Do you think that there is a risk that the money that's coming from these drug companies might go the same way?
I mean, that's a really good point, and I think that's a big fear in a lot of these communities, that the money will not go to help the hospitals and the fire departments and the foster care systems and the rehab centers, that the money may be diverted to other places. There are some who hope that the errors of the past and the tobacco settlements will be a lesson going forward, and that the money will be spent properly. But that's always that's an open question right now, and we're going to have to wait to see. But I think a lot of people are going to be paying much closer attention to what happens to this money, given the past missteps that took place with the tobacco settlements.
There are those who say, of course, that these were companies selling a legal product approved by the FDA. And what's going to be next, alcohol companies or fast food companies?
Yes, well, I mean, and that is the defense that these companies put forth, and it's the defense that they're going to be using at trial if these cases actually make it to trial. They may all settle before this trial date, but they have said that they were merely filling legal prescriptions, that they were paying attention to their responsibilities, and that it was somebody else's responsibility to make sure these drugs were not being diverted to the black market. But there are laws in the United States governing this supply chain from manufacturer to distributor to pharmacy on the retail level. And that is supposed to be a tightly regulated and controlled system. And everybody who is a participant in that system has a responsibility under the law that if they see suspicious orders coming in, they're supposed to report those suspicious orders to the federal government, and they're not supposed to ship them. And the allegation is that they paid very little attention to that law, that they knew or should have known that suspicious orders were coming in, that there were massive orders for large amounts of drugs, and that they were filling those orders regardless and not reporting them to the federal government. And so that's one of the key allegations in these lawsuits.
Can you give me a kind of a picture of what happened in a community when, I suppose, I don't know, did it begin with tramadol? How does it work its way through to cause such devastation?
Well, you know, just going back to what you said a little bit earlier about OxyContin being marketed as a less addictive alternative to some of the other drugs that were on the market, a lot of people believe that they were overprescribed. A lot of people got addicted very quickly to these drugs. They are basically the same. They are the same exact chemical composition of heroin. And so it doesn't take very much to get addicted. So people got addicted to these things very, very quickly. And there became this huge industry surrounding painkillers. There were pain management clinics that were really not pain management clinics, but they were just fronts for criminal organizations of corrupt doctors and corrupt pharmacists. And they were selling prescriptions, and then they were filling the prescriptions knowing that they were false and phony prescriptions. And these pills started just flooding the streets of these little communities. People would go down to Florida. They would fly down there. They would take buses. They would drive down there, and they would bring back the pills. They would bring back the prescriptions and fill them back home. And the pills started going for $1 a milligram on the street. So a 30 milligram tablet, which is the equivalent of a hit of heroin, would be sold for $30. And people were doing those two or three times a day. And so that's people were making a lot of money because they could buy a vial of these drugs for a few dollars and then bring them back to the street and sell them for hundreds of dollars per vial. And so, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars being made by individuals, and then hundreds of thousands and then millions of dollars were being made by drug dealers, by these pill mills, by internet pharmacies. For a time, you could buy these pills over the internet. I mean, it was just the Wild West for a while. And then when they started cracking down on the doctors and on the pill mills and on the pharmacies, and then started cracking down on the drug distributors and the manufacturers, these pills became harder and harder to get. And, you know, drug dealers are very savvy. And the drug dealers in Mexico started to see that there was a market in the United States for heroin. And so instead of buying pills, people started buying heroin because it was cheaper. It was easier to get. It was the same high. And they started doing heroin. And then the drug dealers got even smarter, and they saw an opportunity to start selling fentanyl. That's a synthetic opioid. It mimics the same exact euphoria that you get from heroin or from prescription drugs, and that's even cheaper than heroin. And if you talk to drug addicts, they'll tell you that they prefer fentanyl. It's a better high. It's a cleaner high. They stay higher longer. They don't come down as hard, and they can get it for far cheaper than heroin. And that's the epidemic that we're facing now, is a fentanyl epidemic.
And so, yes, we've got the court cases and we've got millions of dollars being paid out, but you've also got what sounds like entire swathes of the United States completely addicted. What's going to happen?
You know, it's really it's so depressing to go into some of these communities. My partner on the story, Sari Horowitz, and I went to Ohio not too long ago, which is in the middle of America. And these once thriving, you know, textile towns and mill towns and steel towns and big farming communities are like zombie land. I mean, the people literally are walking around, you know, going through garbage cans, sleeping on sidewalks, overdosing in public parks, overdosing in their cars with their children in the back seat. it's surreal going into some of these communities, and it's not just one, but it's hundreds, it's thousands of communities throughout the Midwest of the United States and up and down the East Coast into New England. It is one of the saddest things I've ever seen in my career.
The stories.
So what's going to happen? That's a really good question. Now that fentanyl has moved into these communities, it's killing people faster than anything. The overdose rate in the United States is soaring through the roof, and there's no end in sight. So it's a perplexing problem.
And I'm thinking that your coverage of it is going to continue for quite some time.
Yes, absolutely. Sadly, yes, we'll be sticking with this for quite some time.
Very good to talk to you. Thank you, Scott Higham, who's with the Washington Post Investigative Unit.